Hello and welcome to Unfrozen. My name is Dan Safarik. Greg Lindsay is traveling today, but I am very pleased to introduce our guest for today, whose name is Stefan Ahl, and he is the author of the recently published Super Tall: How the World's Tallest Buildings Are Reshaping Our Cities and Our Lives. Welcome, Stefan.
Thank you, Daniel, and great to be here.
So this is a really interesting book, and perhaps not just to me, our guests probably, or our listeners probably know, my day job is a director of research and thought leadership at the Council on Tall Buildings in Urban Habitat. So when I see the term super tall being used, which in our lexicon means a building of 300 meters or greater height, I'm pretty interested, especially if it was published by someone outside of our organization. So I would be interested to know, Stefan, what interested you about super talls, and kind of how did you come to be interested in writing a skyscraper book? It is a rather crowded shelf, I must say.
Yeah, I understand. Well, you know, very early on in my career, I was fortunate to be able to work on one of the tallest buildings. I joined a small firm in Amsterdam after graduating from Delft, and we worked on this competition. It was kind of a David and Goliath story. We were up against much larger companies, but to our own surprise, we ended up winning the competition and building the tower. So that was the first time that I was kind of exposed to, you know, very tall structures, and I really became quite fascinated with it. And it even prompted me to do a PhD in urban planning, because I realized, you know, when a structure gets to that size, it becomes more than a piece of architecture, but really almost like, you know, a piece of city design, right? And that really changed the trajectory of my life quite a bit. So I ended up doing a PhD and became interested in really large scale projects. I became a professor. I worked at, you know, other companies working on large buildings like KPF, and I've just been fascinated with like large buildings ever since.
That's really interesting. I also like that you immediately sensed that, you know, the skyscraper has an urban habitat implication, mm-hmm. which is something that, you know, even our own organization mm-hmm. realized, you know, about 25 or 30 years into the game when we added the and urban habitat to our name. You know, even today, there's still a criticism, I think, of the industry in general that we don't pay enough attention to the urban implications.
No, you're right. Because they're so large, they have a big kind of footprint, right, in terms of leaving shadows and potentially congesting the streets below, but also being visible from so far away, they really become more than just, you know, private developments in the way skyscrapers of all the building types are also very much like public projects, right? Because everyone can see them and they bear such a big imprint on the city as a whole. So yeah, that's really surprising, or in a way good, that this organization that I'm, of course, very familiar with, decided to add urban habitat or include that in its name. And I think that's very good that that's the case.
So I return the compliment, you know, that you're thinking about this, you know, independently. So I'm interested in the choice of organization that you've taken with the book. It starts off with four of the basic technologies that help make skyscrapers possible. Looks into concrete. Of course, we wouldn't be where we are without that. We certainly wouldn't be anywhere without the elevator, air conditioning, and then a collection of technologies known as dampers that keep buildings from swaying excessively in the mm-hmm. wind.
Yeah.
And then you go into the second part, you get out of the technical realm and into the socioeconomic realm, where you're looking at socioeconomic issues through the lens of four specific skyscraper cities. What drove that organizational principle?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, you know, obviously the first half of the book is about technology, because that is a big driver of kind of super talls, right? Because they're so tall, it's really about withstanding the lateral forces, right? And you need a strong structure, strong materials. You need to bring people up fast. You need to keep them comfortable through air conditioning. And so technology is a big piece of large skyscrapers, maybe more so in skyscrapers than other building types. But I think that wouldn't entirely do the topic justice, right? Because there's so much more to tall buildings that we need to understand to be able to truly explain them. And zoning, right, is a really big thing. If you look at cities across the world, the way in which, I mean, skylines are so different is partially or largely, I should say, because we have different kind of urban planning habits and regulations that allow them to exist in different ways. There's also culture, social preferences, questions around aesthetics, right? So technology alone, I felt, didn't quite do justice on the complexity of the topic. So that's why I divided the book in these two parts, one on technology, the other on society, so I could also shed light on what I believe were some of the other aspects that has shaped them. But generally speaking, I was really going after kind of what are kind of these successive inventions or the successive events that led today's new kind of generation of skyscrapers to exist, what allowed them to be possible and in terms of technology, but also in terms of kind of social preferences and tastes.
Yeah, and I mean, it's definitely an ambitious multidimensional approach in a book that is, you know, it's a sizable book, but it's short compared to some of the tomes that I find myself looking at here on the engineering side, particularly. So in the society section, how did you arrive at the four cities that you selected? You looked at New York, London, Hong Kong, and Singapore. Yeah, and then you kind of use them as a sort of proxy to discuss these broader issues across a range of cities. I mean, for example, the Singapore section, you ended up talking about places like Savannah, Georgia, and Portland, Oregon, which I wasn't expecting. I'm kind of interested how you settled on that and why you decided to keep the names of the cities in the title of the section.
Yeah, well, to be honest, that was the hardest part to write of the book. The first part of the book was the most obvious, I felt, right? If we're talking about very tall buildings, we instantly are drawn in a discussion around, you know, what are the strongest materials? What are the best possible structures, the fastest elevators, right? And that had a pretty good flow to it. But when it comes to the social aspects, I decided to structure it around cities. And I chose the cities that, first of all, I thought, all represent a very different approach to dealing with skyscrapers. But secondly, those were the cities that I myself was most familiar with, having either lived or worked there, and knowing kind of the inside outs of all the kind of the local zoning regulations and the attitudes towards tall buildings. You know, throughout the book, I really wanted to make sure that I was also able to put in my own lived experiences to be able to tell a more holistic story. So the reason I chose those four cities was the following. So New York, obviously, that makes sense, right? No one's going to question the choice of New York as a city in a book about skyscrapers, but I thought it was a good opportunity.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But I thought it was a good opportunity to discuss air rights, right? Because that's really what makes New York quite unique, and that explains a lot of the more recent super slenders, for instance. In the case of London, I chose London because for so long it had resisted skyscrapers, and it's kind of a low-rise heritage city, right? And just for the fact that it now has so many tall buildings, I thought that was worth kind of analyzing, and it allowed me to digress into a lot of the history of regulation in terms of planning a city that eventually led to also planning tall buildings. And what's unique about London is they have these protective view corridors that protect the area or the view corridors from certain parks to monuments like St. Paul's Cathedral. Now, the two other cities that I chose because I thought they have something really good going for them if we're thinking about the future of the skyscraper. So Hong Kong is such a great example of how you can integrate transportation, public transportation, into the built environment. I myself lived in Hong Kong for 3 years, but it's such an efficient city because the transit authority, the MTRC, is also a real estate developer. So they can capitalize on the value they create a, you know, cross-subsidize public transportation with private development, and, you know, create a world-class public transportation system, but at the same time, make a city that's super connected. You can get to virtually anywhere in the city within 40 minutes, which is just amazing. And, you know, the subway has Wi-Fi, it has air conditioning, it runs on time. You can go straight from the subway station into office lobbies. So it's really a great example of transit-oriented development. And then finally, Singapore, which I thought was such a great example of how we can promote skyscrapers to integrate greenery and plants and not just become these kind of concrete pillars. And you know, just taking the Singapore example for Singapore chapter, for example, what struck me is that you know, the case of Singapore really needs to be understood historically. The fact that we are now having greenery inside skyscrapers must really be understood in a long kind of trajectory that dates back 400 years when the French nouveau riche were for the first time bringing in trees into cities and building these boulevards and planting poplar trees into cities, right? So I wanted to tell that, you know, put Singapore in that context because it's not an isolated case. And, you know, it really stands as a shining example, perhaps, of a larger trend of, you know greening cities and green infrastructure. So that's why Savannah came in there, because it was a really early example of planning a city around green squares. So yeah, that's how I landed on those four cities. And yeah, it's not as obvious as the first four chapters, right, around technology. But at the same time, I thought it was important to frame it around kind of a concrete example, and then telling the story of the innovations or the new regulations that led up to that particular event or that particular project in the city.
Yeah, I think that was a really interesting choice, and you know, it was pleasant in a way to sometimes have the digressions, you know, into discussions of things that you didn't expect to be reading about in this book, you know, like the Haussmann Boulevards of Paris or the Ringstrasse in Vienna. So I think it just sort of underscores that a lot of the things that the contemporary architecture community and the larger tall building industry at large sort of try to pull one over on you, in a sense, like pretending like all this stuff is new. You know, the idea of natural ventilation, of greenery, of public space, you know, it's like, well, actually just over 100 years ago, those were the only choices. And that was how you would ventilate a building. That was how you would access light. And we have to sort of reinvent everything over again from the collective forgetting that was international modernism.
Yeah, I love it how you frame that. Yeah, I agree. It's, a lot of, I mean, as a as an architect, you kind of have to be bold and make claims and say this is new and innovative and it's never been done before. But very often history rhymes, right? And there are certain things that we can clearly trace back to much earlier. And I think that's really what's so fascinating about tall buildings too, because if you just think about it, they're kind of the accumulations of so many innovations that happen throughout history. And that's really what strikes me. So for instance, you can go back to Roman concrete or go back even further to something as simple as the portal frame in Stonehenge, right? Like this very simple structural method that was first invented thousands of years, but all of these inventions kind of build upon each other and allow us to create these kind of massive structures. And that was the point of this book, to kind of show what were these kind of unique innovations and how did new innovations build on these old ones to create this, or to culminate in these extremely tall buildings.
Yeah, and it's interesting too that you characterize these as culminations of innovation, which they surely are. And yet at the same time, they can be described as a progress trap. That was a word that came up a couple times in the book. And I was wondering if you could expound a little bit about what you mean by a progress trap and how that jibes with the idea of innovation.
Yeah, so the progress trap is the condition of human societies when they try to pursue progress on one hand, but at the same time, this progress also introduces new problems, and these problems they're unable to solve or they're unwilling to solve. So think about Easter Island, and this is really well described in the book Collapse by Jared Diamond. So here we have a society that was able to build these, amazing Easter Island statues, but by doing so, we're probably, felling trees to make this happen, and many anthropologists believe that through the felling of these trees to create these structures, and this, gradual deforestation, erosion occurred, flooding intensified, and the agricultural surpluses diminished, and eventually the society this brought this food shortage brought social unrest, and eventually led to collapse of that particular society. So obviously this is a dramatic example, and we're not entirely sure if this was indeed the case, but if you look around you, we're living in an age of unprecedented building, urbanization, lots of new construction, but also knowing that 40% of global carbon emissions stems from the built environment, and we're living in an age of climate change, so we're really seeing maybe a macro or global progress trap, right? And we always frame urbanization around progress. And that's true in many ways, right? Because cities are more productive than rural societies, and we have more ability to connect with other people, but at the same time, it does come at a cost. There's this Greek myth that I evoke, and I keep thinking about that myth, and it's the story of Prometheus and how he stole fire from the gods to give it to humans. And of course, this was progress for humans. But what the gods did when they realized that Prometheus had done this, they wanted to counteract this blessing, and they sent Pandora's box. And when it opened, it unleashed a lot of troubles around the earth for humans. I think that really is a story that applies, I think, to a lot of technology, right? So you can go back to the invention of concrete through cement, right? Which on one hand was, a great invention that allowed us for so many things, through, creating strong airport runways to buildings to bridges, obviously skyscrapers, right? But at the same time, concrete is extremely carbon intensive in terms of producing it, right? And in particular, for burning lime, it emits a lot of carbon into the atmosphere. So it's clearly like a double-edged sword. And you can think more recent innovations like, the smart city or the smart building. On one hand, it's new technology that allows us to know where people are, what they're doing, so we can have more sustainable buildings and, reduce the amount of energy that we use to light or heat or cool building in certain parts of the building when they're not being used, for instance. But at the same time, they also add a potential downside in what could be kind of the next, George Orwell, 1984, where Big Brother is always watching you and there's no longer any sense of privacy. So I wanted to make sure that I kind of frame these innovations as progress, but still be cautious of any potential downsides that happen as a result of it. So that's a big theme in the book. So I'm glad you picked up on that.
Oh yes, there's no shortage of paradoxes in this world. So I think one of the other thing that I really liked about the book was that you share a bunch of anecdotes that I hadn't heard before, which impressed me because I consider myself an old hand in the skyscraper world. I've been doing this for almost 10 years, and I was curious how you came across some of these tidbits. Couple of the ones that really struck me, without giving away the whole book, were the experiments that were undertaken to test the potential to sway of the World Trade Center, the original World Trade Center, taking place in Oregon, through Vision Eye Care Centers, something like that. And then the other one that was great was the invention of air conditioning by Carrier. Who was trying to solve the problem of newsprint slipping off of pages in humid conditions, so it seems. How did you come across those pieces of information and others like it?
Yeah, it just I've always been really interested in these kind of weird anecdotes that explain how a certain innovation happens, because it's never linear, right? The way things go, it's not that you want to solve a problem and you can kind of trace out all the steps that you do in a linear way. There's always this kind of weird. This weird path of how that happens. And just to give you an example of air conditioning, right? The whole industry of air conditioning came out of this particular problem, which was really not related to it. It was a problem that a printer had in Brooklyn a little over 120 years ago. And they suffered from air that was too humid. And the engineer that solved the air humidity issue, because the problem with the too much humidity in the air is that you can't quite control the contraction of the paper, and that's a problem when you're printing like multiple colors on a piece of page. So every time that the paper or the page expands or contracts, the print registers, they wouldn't align. So they hired this engineer. He solved the issue of humidity, but what he didn't realize is that he had created an entire new industry around cooling buildings, because he solved the issue through also controlling the air temperature. But the funny thing was is that the moment he invented this, he thought he had found a solution for really niche industries like printing presses or storing things that don't handle humidity, like macaroni, right? It took him years to realize that this would really revolutionize and not just printing, but you know, buildings and many other things. So it just struck me that this was so surprising, right? That this was completely kind of unexpected, even by the engineer himself, who invented this invention. He didn't realize the massive implications it would bring. So yeah, like progress goes in weird ways, and sometimes, you know, things are done that are not entirely ethical. So in the case of the World Trade Center, they realized that if a building sways too much for people who are at the top floors, they may become uncomfortable. But they didn't quite know how much sway can you have in a building. So they started doing tests. And the way they did tests is that they kind of lured people in unknowingly in this optometrist office far away from New York, all the way in Oregon, by giving them like a free eye exam. But what they didn't realize is the moment they entered this optometrist office is that actually this was a shaking floor that would shake over time. Not even the optometrist was aware of the shaking. And that's how they were trying to test to see what are the limits for people to be comfortable in these conditions of sway.
That's remarkable. I just keep, there's so many layers in that. It kind of almost feels like they set up Scientology in order to test engineering principles. Yeah. Like, are you stressed? Yeah. How about a free stress test? Step into this room. It's funny how veiled that was compared to the transparency that surrounds similar tests for, you know, much higher aspect ratio of skyscrapers today, like at 432 Park. I'm sure you've seen Raphael Vignoli make the rounds, at least within the architecture and engineering community, talking about how they figured out how to prevent the people who were buying $100 million apartments from seeing their champagne glasses swirling their champagne and their chandeliers from swaying too much. They set up a whole, shake table at a facility that was actually meant to train boat pilots to take freighters through the St. Lawrence Seaway, and demonstrated it thus, with a full scale mock-up of the interior of an apartment in that building. So we've come a long way in terms of, transparency, even if some of the testing modes are actually pretty similar.
Wow, that's a great story. It's just, weird how now that has become a feature, right? And you can be so tall and not sway and still have a chandelier that hangs straight, I suppose. So again, we're trying to solve the problem that was a byproduct of our ability to create these new buildings. So you solve one problem and then you create the next in a way. So it's kind of interesting how that goes.
So it seems. So I'm really interested too. You approach this from a slightly different angle. I didn't mention at the top of the podcast that you're also a professor. So I should put you in two camps, at least, architect, author, professor. That in and of itself is not an uncommon combination, but you're approaching this also from the position of having been a practitioner who designed a tall structure, which we won't call a building. Canton Tower is a structure in CTBUH lingo because it is less than 50% occupiable. But I'll let you go on that one. It is not only super tall, it is mega tall. So you definitely have standing in this field. But more to the point, a lot of books on this topic, they're either written by the architects who designed the buildings, talking about how great they are, or they're from historians who are looking at it at a strictly economic or engineering viewpoint. Or you have social critics who really just want to, attack this whole phenomenon because of the lockbox in the sky issue of protecting wealth. And you managed to attack it from all three angles at once. And I'm just curious about that. Where do you think you fit on the shelf between something like Iceberg Zombies in the Ultra Thin by Matthew Sewells or Digital Monuments by Simone Brart?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So, you know, first I should say that, you know, all the categories that the Council of Tall Buildings and Urban Habitats are, they're interesting categories, but at the same time, it would be worth discussing too. For instance, the super tall limit of why is it at 300 meters, right? Which is kind of an arbitrary number, especially considering that a lot of the early skyscrapers were built in the United States, not quite kind of a metric, and they didn't quite have a metric, scill, right, in front of them. So I'm bringing this up because I just did a talk at the Skyscraper Museum with Carol Willis and Paul Goldberger, and Carol mentioned how for their exhibit of the super tall, they decided that the cutoff should be the height of the Empire State Building instead of 300 meters. So I'd be curious to know your take on that. But yeah, how did I come up with telling this story in this particular way, not really just focusing on kind of social criticism or just kind of the technological pieces or the history pieces? Well, it's partially because like a good architect, I think, you know, a good building should not only be, you know, standing stable, right, and should not collapse, and should be structurally sound, but it should also fit well into the city context. It should provide an environment for social relationships to thrive. It should make a symbolic and an aesthetic statement. So for me, like, architecture is broad enough to also to be able to include kind of histories of particular technologies, but also kind of the social relationships that happen as a result, or even, you know, why we perceive things as beautiful or not beautiful. So for me, I think, you know, architecture is one of those fields that are really, it's on one hand very technical, right? But at the same time, it's also kind of an art form, and it has kind of social implications. So I've always been interested. I mean, that's the very reason why I chose architecture, because I thought it was quite of a broad discipline, even though when you work as an architect, very often you're just narrowly focused on just doing the building. But in a way, I think many architects, they are what we call reflexive practitioners, right? And that in order to become a better architect, you have to be very critical about kind of the discipline and take feedback and see how things can get better. So that's why I wanted to kind of tell the story the way I did it. So if you compare it to those other books, you know, it's not quite social criticism, right? At the same time, it's also not a manifesto, and it's also not just kind of history. It's kind of all these things together. But in my view, that is the best way of kind of telling the story of this, the super tall. And to be frank, I didn't do a lot of market research when I wrote this book. And it was just the book that made sense for me to write myself. So I wasn't too preoccupied on, you know, how it would fit between other books on the shelf. Maybe because there's so many books already. And if I would think about that too much, I'd probably be paralyzed and really not be able to write a single word.
Well, I would say that it's broken through on a couple of fronts. I mean, you know, I think I read about it first in a review in The Guardian. I saw maybe the South China Morning Post publish something about it with kind of making the take that they thought the comparison with between Hong Kong and Singapore was a little bit unflattering toward Hong Kong, which I don't necessarily agree with, but that's how they read it.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's making the rounds. Well done. And do you have a sense of how it's doing in academia? Or, I mean, it seems like you've been invited by some of the major scholars already.
Yeah, I mean, mostly because it was published with Norton, and you know, they're more of a trade publisher, right? So they're pitching it to all the big media outlets, so the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, you know, Forbes, you know, South China Morning Post, and NPR, those venues, and they've been very receptive to it. Academia is a little bit slower, and it hasn't been quite the priority, but there's been some interest from several academics. So, but it will probably take a while before we see any reviews there, because of the, you know, it's just longer lead times for these journals to get published. So, so yeah, we'll see.
I can confirm that, because I was pitched as one of them, and I came around and I actually said, well, I'll do two things. I'll do a short review in our journal, which I will do. And then I have another opportunity, which is this very small podcast, but where we can talk as long as we want about anything we want. And it's very instantaneous.
That's great. Yeah, no, so that's great. So I'm glad you're doing this. And yeah, it's a true honor, because, you know, of all people, you definitely know everything about Skyscraper. So I'm truly honored. And, you know, in a way, a book like this is an opportunity for me to talk to other people who are really into Skyscraper. So I was also really flattered by Paul Goldberger and his review of the New York Times. And he wrote, yeah, he wrote one of the first books on skyscrapers, and wrote on the World Trade Center. So it was just a unique opportunity for me to also know his thoughts. And because, yeah, I'd love to have more discussions with other people. It's such a fascinating topic, right? The tall building and density, the vertical city, and it's also so complicated. So I'm always eager to learn what other experts are thinking about, and I'd love to pick their brain.
Well, thanks for letting me pick yours today. It was really great having you on the cast, and I wish the best of luck in putting the word back out there. Well, thanks so much, Stefan. It's Stefan Ahl, author of Super Tall, How the World's Tallest Buildings Are Reshaping Our Cities and Our Lives, out now from Norton. Thanks again, Stefan.
Thank you very much. Really enjoyed our conversation.